Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So the theme of tonight's lecture is predestination, and specifically to consider what the Catholic teaching signifies in its use of the word predestination, and then where predestination fits within a Catholic theology of creation and recreation. And then at the end, we'll just give little sketches, little kind of treatments of objections to the Catholic teaching on predestination. But my hope is that that will create a space in which you can ask your questions or pose your objections, and we can start a conversation. Okay, so what exactly is entailed by the Christian belief in predestination? I think many people associate predestination with Calvinism or Reformed Presbyterianism, and this idea that one goes to heaven or that one goes to hell by God's sovereign will, and that the contribution of the individual is minimal, if existent. But the Catholic teaching, as we'll see, on the doctrine of predestination is distinct, and it affords space for Christian hope and for the participation of the Christian or the exercise of his or her agency. But this teaching isn't widely known, and it's a teaching which I think stands to free us or stands to animate us in our response to the preaching of the gospel and to the reception of sacramental grace. So when we inquire, we might find kind of proposals or solutions which at first seem troubling, but which I think we'll find at the end of the day are consoling and encouraging. So the manner of proceeding is first to explain what is meant by predestination in the setting of Catholic theological tradition, and then, and in this I'll rely a lot on St. Thomas Aquinas, which I know is a surprise. And then I'll explain how it is situated within a theology of creation and recreation, and then again, address objections. So first, what is meant by predestination in the Catholic setting? As you know from the word itself, pre, before, destination, signifying the terminus, in this case, of a human life, so that in some way, shape, or form, the terminus of a human life is known and perhaps willed prior to its effectuation or prior to its realization. So in short, predestination refers to God's efficacious foreknowledge of our salvation. Okay, so God's efficacious foreknowledge of our salvation. And the basic teaching is that this doctrine is called for by the nature of supernatural beatitude. So again, we hear that word supernatural, beyond what is natural, or beyond what pertains to our nature. So you can think about it in these terms. How does one attain to heaven? If we are to attain to heaven, how will we get there? By whose resources? All right? By whose competence? Clearly, heaven is beyond our own resources, because it's supernatural. It is in a certain sense defined as falling without the bounds or outside the bounds of our competence. So if we are to arrive there, we must be directed there by one with sufficient resources, by one with genuine competence in the matter. The image that St. Thomas uses is that of an arrow. He'll say that an arrow only ever attains its mark or hits its target if it is directed there by an archer. All right, so arrows don't just proceed of their own volition to hit targets. They must be shot from a bow by a competent archer with resources exceeding that of the arrow. Now, as you can see, the analogy isn't perfect because an arrow can't think and an arrow can't feel, whereas we can think and we can feel. So we're going to see that our participation or our sharing in the drama of salvation is at once more responsible, and also more exciting. All right, so even more exciting than shooting an arrow at a target. So the idea is that we, if we are to attain to the end, must attain to that end by someone else's resources or by someone else's competence. And what the doctrine of predestination says is that that's God's resources or that's God's competence. So the reason for our movement to heaven pre-exists in God. The reason for our movement to heaven pre-exists in God. So perhaps you've come across the doctrine of the divine ideas, all right? And so God, in knowing himself, this is a doctrine that you really hear enunciated in the Platonic tradition, and you'll hear a kind of statement of it in St. Augustine in his On 83 Questions, but then a classic formulation of it is found in St. Thomas Aquinas. But the idea is that God, in knowing himself, knows all of the ways in which creatures can share in his life. All right, so God, in knowing himself, knows all of the ways in which creatures can share in his life.
Some of those ways he joins his will to. Some of those ways he wills into existence. Some of those ways he does not.
We refer to those as
pure possibles, never to be realized,
never to be effectuated. But in the case of those things which have existed, or do exist, or will exist, we refer to those as divine ideas or divine exemplars. So God, in knowing himself,
knows all of the ways in which creation or creatures can partake in his
divine life. To some he weds his will. All right?
We refer to those as ideas or
exemplars, and those are the pattern of our existence. And those ideas,
those exemplars, they account for the whole of each creature's life,
or in the case of things that don't live, in the whole of each creature's
existence.
Okay, so that's true for rocks, that's true for plants, that's true for animals, that's true for human beings, that's true for angels. God knows the whole trajectory of each creature's life, and he weds his will to that trajectory. Okay? So we are just the instantiations of this divine idea. And the idea, obviously, includes the end of our lives. It includes our eternal destiny. It includes the final state at which we will arrive and in which we will persevere for ages of ages. Okay? In saecula saeculorum. So the idea is this notion that includes our final destination and wills it into existence, we refer to as predestination, and specifically with respect to those who arrive in heaven. So you can see that this notion of predestination, or this reality of predestination, pertains to God's work of creation, but it also includes his work of recreation, because it takes into account, or it accounts for, the saving work of our Lord Jesus Christ. So God has a notion for how he creates and recreates each of his creatures, and that notion is so potent that it causes the whole trajectory, the whole unfolding of each creature's existence or each creature's life. Now, we say that this exists in God, and that's, truth be told, the only place in which it exists. All right, it doesn't exist in us except in its effect. Maybe a more helpful way to formulate this teaching is we don't know. Okay, and truth be told, we won't know until the end. And it doesn't pertain to us to know. It doesn't pertain to us to know. T.S. Eliot, a famous American who became British, he has a poem called The Four Quartets, which maybe you've come across before. But he describes in extended fashion the human project or the human effort. He describes our attempts to make sense of things with words, in relationships and interactions. And then he kind of lapses into silence at the end of one of his stanzas, and he says, "The rest is not our business." At another point in the same poem, he says, "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." And God doesn't burden us with this knowledge. All right? God doesn't burden us with this knowledge. So, the way that we have access to it is through faith, hope, and charity, through the theological life. Effectively, we trust that God in his plan of creation and recreation makes all things work to the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. We trust that God's plans are patterned on his wisdom and that they are wrought in his love. God has no need to create. It doesn't add anything to him. It supplies for no lack in him. God has no need for creatures. And yet he creates so that we might participate in his life. He creates for his glory, that is to say, the manifestation and communication of his divine life in creation, and for our salvation. The point of creation is that each rank would share and participate in God's life in the way for which it's suited. We, as made to the image and likeness of God, are suited to participate in God's life by knowing and loving and proceeding freely towards our end. Okay, so God wills that these plans, which he has wrought in wisdom, or that he has kind of formulated in wisdom and wrought in love, take place. But he does not give to us a perfect access or a perfect knowledge of these plans. All right, so this is a kind of basic setting. We can add a couple more points of clarification before we then proceed to a situating of this within this theology of creation and recreation. So we teach, or you know, Christians, Catholics teach, that predestination is antecedent to merit. All right, there are various positions on this, some of which have been ruled out, and some of which have not been ruled out. But at least St. Thomas teaches that God doesn't look and say, how are these people going to use my grace? Are they going to consent to it or cooperate with it? Or are they going to reject it or misuse it? And then if he foresees that they will make good use of it, he gives it. If he foresees that they will make bad use of it, he does not give it. That's a position which you may have come across called Molinism. All right? St. Thomas is not a Molinist. St. Thomas is a Thomist. okay, so St. Thomas teaches that God gives his graces antecedent to our merits. Thank you. He gives his graces antecedent to our merits. That is to say, he doesn't kind of foresee how things will go and then make his judgments on the basis, because that would make God reactive. It would, in a certain sense, make God passive to human agency, whereas God remains always and everywhere active. All right, we're living in God's world. He's not living in ours. All right, we abide by his rules. He doesn't play by ours. That's good news, because his game is better than the game that we play. His game represents an invitation into a world beyond, into a life wholly beyond our present experience, in which he will wipe away every tear from our eyes, in which there will be no death or mourning. All right, so our access to this plan is not by creating a set of circumstances in which it feels more palatable to us, but to trust that God's plans are wise and loving. And also, just a final point of clarification, Catholics hold for single predestination, not double predestination. So the basic teaching is that if a person goes to heaven, it is by God's grace. If a person goes to hell, it is because that person has freely and culpably rejected God's grace. And to be clear, we make no judgments as to the population of hell. All right, we don't know who is there. And we make no particular judgments, no peculiar judgments as to their names or as to their number. All right? We have some confidence, right, that the evil one is there with his fallen angels, with his demons. But as to human beings, we don't know. And we derive no real benefit from speculating, if that makes sense. Okay? Okay, so that's the basic teaching. I would just like to expand so that you can think about that as one circle, and now we're going to make a bigger concentric circle in which we make an attempt to situate this teaching within a broader notion of creation and recreation. I've kind of hinted or given initial indication of where we intend to go, but now I just want to expand it now that we have a basis for proceeding. So we have said that God creates out of goodness and for goodness. All right, so not out of need, but out of generosity. So there is a kind of infinite fruitfulness to the divine life. God's divine life is so rich, all right, it's so potent, that it almost spills over the bounds of God's life, all right, over the bounds of God himself. That's to speak metaphorically, okay? So don't hold me to that. But we don't hold for a kind of Neoplatonic emanationism, as if God is bound to create, as if God creates as a matter of necessity. This represents for him a choice. But his choice to us will always be a bit mysterious, in the sense that we don't know exactly what God is doing. And even in heaven, we won't know exactly what God is doing. We'll get greater clarity as to what he is doing, and we'll have deeper sympathy with what he is doing. We'll begin to see his justice and mercy reconciled more profoundly. We'll begin to have an appreciation for why he permitted pain and suffering in our lives and the way in which those permissions conduce to glory and salvation. We'll begin to see some of those things, but we'll never be able to comprehend God, because God is greater than our minds, greater than our hearts. So in a certain sense, the most that we can say as to why God creates is because he thought we might like it. That sounds trivial, right? That sounds banal, right? But it's like as if God had a secret too good to keep. And so he tells that secret in creation because he wants someone with whom to share it. Again, I'm speaking metaphorically, so don't hold me to this. Nevertheless, we can't say God had to create, God needed to create, God's creation is the necessary outworking of this or that attribute. No, it's gratuitous. It's free. In fact, it's highest freedom. And that God makes us, all right, we've already indicated, but I'd like to visit with greater kind of specificity or in greater detail. God makes us to participate in his divine life. Okay, that's the very purpose for which we exist. Now, we've given indication that we participate in divine life in a way that's peculiar to us, or particular to us as human beings.
In a way that goes beyond rocks and plants and animals. Because it's unique to us among material creation, or among material creatures, that we have a mind with which to know and a heart with which to love. All right, so there is a certain indeterminacy at work in our thinking
and in our choosing. Because we have a spiritual nature, albeit one wed to a bodily form, but a spiritual nature which gives rise to spiritual activity born of spiritual powers. All right, and spirit is kind of on its own terms, unlimited. All right, so like for instance, you're not satisfied by knowing one true thing, nor are you satisfied by by experiencing or embracing one good thing. All right, you may have had like the best imaginable meal at midday, okay? And ¿cuál es la palabra para sandalia?
Jorache.
Comimos unos jorachos esta comida. Okay, so like you may have gotten up from the table and said, that was magnificent, right? That was the best meal I've ever had. I will never eat again. And then 3 hours later, you'll think to yourself, but maybe I could have a little snack, you know? And that's just in the sensible order. In the intelligible order, it's typically our experience that when we know, it inspires in us a deeper inquiry or a fuller inquiry. And that when we love, it pulls from us or it elicits from us a more ardent desire. When Garrigou Lagrange talks about the Blessed Virgin Mary, for instance, who, by the way, grew in the life of grace over the course of her life, he describes her as like a meteor approaching the surface of the earth that never hits terminal velocity, all right? So she continues to accelerate at a steady rate, all right? But she just keeps on picking up speed, moving at greater and greater rates, okay? So there is a sense in which, as we come to know and as we come to love, it precipitates or it kind of propels richer knowledge and richer affection. Okay, so we are broken open to infinity. As made to the image and likeness of God, we are capable of knowing and loving, and not just that, we're capable of knowing and loving everything, even God. And in the highest realization of this nature, we're capable of knowing God with his own knowledge of himself and loving him with his own love of himself. So our nature suits us to return to God. All right? You have fathers of the church working in the Latin language who say, Imago Dei, Capax Dei Est. The image of God is just capacity or capaciousness for God, okay? So that capacity is meant to be fulfilled. It's meant to be realized. Some of you may be sensitive to an ongoing debate about the twofold end of man. You might hear kind of resonances of that debate in this description. We're going to set that aside because that's subject for another lecture. But the basic idea is that God has made us for himself. He created us in grace, and we are in a certain sense ruined for life. Because having had the experience of grace, we are always haunted by a nostalgia for grace, which will continually conduct us unto the fullness of life until such time as we rest in him. So there is no staying still here on the surface of the earth. There is only ever moving towards God or away from him. Now, we also have reason to believe that God is drawing us to himself. Okay? So it's not as if we are created and then left to ourselves, or recreated in grace and then, again, left to ourselves. The gift of creation, the gift of recreation, is continually on offer. It's something that God pours out by an ongoing gratuity, an ongoing generosity. So it's not just one time and done. It's unto ages of ages. All right, until we take our last breath, and please God, persevere in grace and abide with him forever. So we profess that, like, it's not neutral, or it's not as if the scale is balanced, you know, equally for salvation or perdition. We profess, I mean, with the Apostle Paul in his first letter to St. Timothy, God desires that all be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. And God's desire is efficacious, all right? It's not a vague desire, an abstract desire that remains at a distance. It's a desire that is in constant pursuit, okay? So this helps us to kind of fill out the claim that God creates for goodness and unto goodness, or out of goodness and for goodness, and that he makes us to participate in his divine life. All right, remember we did a small circle to get a sense. Now we're doing a bigger circle to better situate that core doctrine, to kind of take a look at it from different vantage points and appreciate the richness of the church's philosophical and theological tradition on this point. So then, let's talk about what we do. All right, let's get more into the details of what we do. Basically, the claim is that we are responsible for not resisting. All right, this is, I suppose, the heart of the claim. That God is in pursuit. That God is in search of our souls. If he has his way, he will draw us to himself. All right? And we can make distinctions about his antecedent and consequent will. His antecedent will being his will kind of abstractly conceived, and then his consequent will being his will concretely conceived as taking into account all of the pertinent circumstances of human agency, but just know that we can return to that in the question and answers if you'd like. So God is in pursuit. He seeks us out. And in order for us as creatures with this nature, that is creatures made to the image and likeness of God, capable of knowing, capable of loving, that is to say, capable of thinking through our salvation, capable of choosing it freely as salvation in its kind of proper sense, as addressed to us, as a kind of invitation that's proposed to us, then we are responsible for not resisting that offer. I think that our salvation largely amounts to us saying to God, this may as well happen. Which isn't the most noble thing, right? Or it's not the most romantic or exotic thing you've ever heard said about salvation. But I think that it helps us to appreciate that God is in pursuit. God is in search. Again, I'm speaking somewhat metaphorically, but I want to communicate this point, that the offer of grace is potent. All right, the offer of grace is strong. Sometimes, for instance, when we read Genesis 3, and we read about the original gift given to our first parents, and then we see that it only really lasted for 5 verses, we begin to wonder about the grace of God. All right? Is it powerful? Is it strong? Or is it fragile? Is it volatile? Are we at risk of losing the love of God? I think the basic point here is that we are not at risk of losing the love of God. All right, sure, we can sin mortally. We can commit grave sin and seek to chase the love of God from our interior life, or seek to turn from him in preference of a created good. But that love always remains on offer. All right, like the love of a father, like the love of a mother. There is nothing that we can do to jeopardize it in its principle. All right, because the fact of our ongoing creation, the continual offer of salvation, is ongoing testimony that God is for us, that he is not against us. Okay. So one way in which the tradition speaks about this phenomenon is to say that grace, God's offer of grace, or God's grace itself, is intrinsically efficacious and yet resistible. All right, so grace, which is given, has its way in us, all right, but it's something that we can resist. It's something to which we can pose obstacles or hindrances. We can put things in the way in order to make it difficult, as it were, for God to do in us what he seeks to do in us. Obviously, God can do whatever he does. But nevertheless, he wills that we come to knowledge of the truth. He wills that we come to embrace of the good through our proper principles. Okay, so God makes us to be from him and for him, but it remains for us in this offer of grace to be from him and for him in the way that he wills. The basic idea here is that our lives are a gift of God in the natural order and in the supernatural order. And if we are to possess them wholly and entirely unto ages of ages, we must continue to receive them, and especially at the end of our lives, continue to receive them as a gift, in recognition that we can only ever have them as a gift. So on God's terms. And if we seek to have them on our terms, we lose them. That's the basic idea. God makes us to be from him and for him, but we have to be from him and for him in the way that he wills, which is to say, as a gift, as an expression of gratuity, as an expression of generosity, specifically as a grace. All right? Now, God continues to offer us this grace throughout the course of our lives, he continues to offer us graces throughout the course of our lives, so that we can come in turn to consent to and cooperate with this offer, so that we can, by our own proper principles, as capable of knowledge, as capable of love, incline freely to the offer. All right? And so you'll have, again, Reginald Gary Gulagrange says that at every minute of every day, God is offering even to the most hardened sinners at least the grace sufficient to pray. And you'll say to yourself, okay, well, what does this grace count for? It's not the grace of justification. Well, we talk about prevenient grace and consequent grace, or grace that comes before and grace that comes after. In our experience, when we respond to graces that come before, we discover that there are graces that come after, which have a kind of logic to them, which exercise a kind of pedagogy in leading us further up and further into the divine life. So let's say you can picture somebody who is outside of the faith, right, who does not believe, but who receives a grace to come to a Thomistic Institute lecture. All right? A great grace indeed. And maybe, you know, most of the talk makes no sense, all right, because they're speaking in philosophical or theological jargon. But maybe one sentence breaks through, or one word registers, and the person says to himself, maybe there's something there. And then the next day or the next week, he receives a grace. He's up on, you know, the second floor over here, passing by the chapel. And he thinks, I haven't been in this room. Maybe I could go in this room. And maybe it isn't the most perfect prayer time. He says to himself, there's like a very thin veil around the tabernacle. I wonder why. It's like, what is that? I mean, that seems like it would make it hard to open the tabernacle. You know, he might spend all of his time in the chapel thinking about a weird veil. But maybe there's a grace there. And maybe he enjoyed his time there. Or maybe he fell asleep and he had a good nap. That can happen too. I don't mean to be impious, you know, that can be sweet. And he thinks to himself, I am an anxious man. I could use a good nap. And so he begins to go there once a week to get a little 7 minutes before his last class each day. But then, I don't know, he gets more well-rested, and then he stays awake for those 7 minutes, and then you can see how this works, right? Graces that come before lead to graces that come after. And God is continually offering graces according to a certain trajectory with a certain pedagogy so as to lead us further up and further in. And the idea is that these graces are always on offer. All right? St. Thomas likens them to the rays of the sun. All right, they are always being emitted. But our responsibility is to make sure that we don't put things in the way. All right, that we don't close the shutters of the window through which this light pours, or allow dirt to accumulate on the window pane. That we, with the natural law at work in our hearts, perhaps aided by some of these graces that come before, we do what lies within our power to be genuinely curious about our experience, and then honest with what we find, and then to kind of hold that in dialogue. So then, God is giving us these graces in the setting of a genuine human life, which takes time, which unfolds in an appeal to our genuine freedom. Because God will save us according to our proper principles, right? He'll save us as human beings, not as rocks, not as plants, not as animals, but as human beings made to the image and likeness of God, who are capable of knowing and capable of loving, who can think through and choose for what they take to be their end. That's how we as human beings come to our completion or come to our fulfillment. All right? So the last point that I'll say, and then maybe I'll treat an objection or two and open it up for questions, is to say that we need to recognize that we're fighting something of an uphill battle. And at many times, it won't seem fair, but we can trust that it is potentially beautiful, potentially wonderful. Because we know from salvation history that we live in the ruins of a primordial catastrophe, that we live in the wreckage of terrible destruction. All right, so our first parents, they chose against God and against his plan. So God willed from the start that we come into this world enlightened by grace, rectified in our nature, and in the enjoyment of all kinds of wild privileges like impassibility and immortality. But because of the sin of our first parents, we come into this world deprived of those graces. We might think to ourselves, I didn't choose, but in a certain sense, we did. Because our parents chose for us. They chose for their family. We're present in their nature. We're present in their choice. We're present in their loins. And so we are justly wounded in our nature and despoiled of grace, or wounded in our nature and deprived of grace. And so when we come into this world, we come into this world on a kind of downward trajectory. You'll hear voices in the tradition who say that left to our own resources, we merit death. We merit damnation. And that is a very scary thing, and it sounds very unfair, right? And I think it's fine to admit that. You don't have to feel embarrassed, you know, or whatever to admit that. But this becomes in turn the backdrop against which the story of recreation is told. Namely, that our Lord Jesus Christ has delivered us from damnation, from sin and its wages, which are death. G.K. Chesterton has this beautiful little meditation in Orthodoxy, where he says when he was a young boy, one of his favorite pieces of poetry was a part of the story Robinson Crusoe, where Robinson Crusoe gets shipwrecked and then he washes up on the shore of an island. And then the author spends some time describing the various items that wash up on the shore with him. And Chesterton says that each of those items appears to be ideal, because each of those items could have been lost in the sea. And so you can see, against the backdrop of this primordial catastrophe, the story of salvation appears yet more magnificently, because all of us have been saved from a wreck. Because all of us, like those items which washed up on the shore, have had a narrow escape. All of us could have been otherwise, or we could not have been, and yet here we are. So the offer is addressed to us in this state, or the offer is addressed to us in the midst of our damnable condition. And it takes into account our actual lives, our actual circumstances. So we say that God wills that necessary things happen necessarily, and that free things happen freely. And we're genuinely free. And these are the terms of our freedom, that if we are to attain to salvation, it is by God's offer of grace to which we can consent, all right, with which we can cooperate. At the very least, we can say, you know, this may as well happen, right? But that makes of our lives something yet more beautiful or something yet more wonderful. God doesn't need sin in order to bring about an excellent work, but he will use it to bring about something awesome, okay? So, I think that, you know, this is kind of, we did the initial sketch, and then we did the broader sketch as a way by which to appreciate what exactly is at stake. God has a notion as to each of our lives, a notion that includes the whole trajectory, including whether we are bound for heaven. And God, knowing that, offers us a participation in his life which appeals to our freedom, such that we can be from him and for him in the way that God wills, as the fruit of our choice, which he engenders. And God himself can operate within us, interior to us, intimately in our own lives, to pull forth or to elicit that response in freedom. Because as the giver of our nature, he does not transgress our nature. And so then the story of salvation is a drama whereby the offer of grace continually made available to us is progressively or gradually made real or appropriated in the life of each Christian. So, this gives us a kind of overall sketch, and maybe then I'll just treat one objection and then take some of your questions. Okay, so one objection is, isn't God responsible for getting everyone to heaven? Okay, isn't God responsible for getting everyone to heaven? Here, I would just say, no. At least in the way in which we typically formulate this sentence. Because we typically say responsibility with a human notion of justice in mind. But the conversation to this point has set us up to appreciate that God's not playing our game. We're playing his game. God's justice is not our justice. It's not unrelated to our justice. It causes our justice. But it doesn't suffer from the defects or the lacks of our justice. It is super eminently just. That is to say, righteous beyond compare. God is not just one cause in among a mess of causes, but he interacts with creation, or he interposes himself in creation in a gratuitous way, right? Not after the manner of fairness, but in the manner of generosity, in the manner of abundance. Like, this is all extra. It could not have been, or it could have been otherwise. So, in furnishing us, or in giving us our nature, and in giving us a responsibility for our nature, he makes us capable, or he capacitates our free action. Okay? So God furnishes us with everything that we need in order to flourish, and he continually offers super added gifts as a way by which to conduct us to himself. But he's not responsible for saving everyone. He made us this way, to glorify him in this way, and to be saved in this way. And this way is free. So God appeals to our freedom. He engenders our freedom. He heals and grows our freedom. He acts interior to our freedom. But he does not transgress our freedom. Or at least he does not run roughshod over our freedom. Okay. So then the last objection before we pass to your questions is, how can we possibly be responsible for something so big? Right? It's like, okay, if God's not responsible for saving everyone, then in a certain sense, we are responsible for consenting to and cooperating with his grace. But it seems like we have 70 years here on the surface of the earth, 80 for those who are strong, says the psalmist. How can we possibly be responsible for choosing unto ages of ages? Here, I think that the simple statement is to say that we are already living unto ages of ages. All right? I would say that maybe a simple response is to counter in adjusting our kind of present experience and saying it's not as if the earth is radically divorced from heaven or from hell, but there is this time in which heaven and hell overlap. Okay? So St. Catherine of Siena will say, all the way to heaven is heaven. Or C.S. Lewis will say, at the end of our days, we will look back at our time on earth and we will recognize it. For those who end in hell, they'll look back at their time on earth and they will recognize it as hell on earth. For those who end in heaven, they'll look back at their time on earth and recognize it to have been heaven on earth. So the question is, how do we want to live now? And that is the thing for which we are responsible. That's not to add inordinate pressure to your life, all right? We all have snacks, we all take naps, right? We all get frustrated, we all get distracted. But the question is, can you do your best with the gifts you are given in the time you are afforded, abandoned to God's providence, subject to your prudence, trusting that he makes all things work to the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose? When St. Thomas asks, what does it mean to love God with your whole mind, heart, soul, and strength? He says it means to refer our actions to God and to will a higher state, to trust, to hope that God can pull forth from us things which we can't pull forth from ourselves, but which he, in his infinite generosity or gratuity, is content to do. So I think it's with that disposition that we can abandon ourselves to God's predestinating will, to his saving designs, all right? Because he desires that all be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.